All right, guys, I've got a big guy for you today. Former president of the Society for Consumer Psychology, Kravis Professor of Business, unbelievably highly cited. Go to his Google Scholar page. Michel Pham. How you doing, Michel?
Hi, Gad. How are you?
Great. It's so nice to finally sit down with you. As you know, I invited also Brian Wansink, so I'm trying to create a series within my YouTube channel of, you know, really interesting consumer researchers so that people can hopefully get excited about the things that we do. And so thank you so much for accepting to be on.
Well, thank you for having me, Gad. I'm very flattered that you would pick me with Brian.
I want to tell people how we originally first met. Do you remember where we
first met? I remember everything, Gad.
Okay, so do you want to tell this? Do you want to tell the story, or do you want me to tell the story?
Oh, I don't know. It's up to you. I'm happy to fill in the blank.
Okay, so let me start. So there's this doctoral consortium that happens every year where you know, business schools that have PhD programs in our field will choose a doctoral fellow to represent them at this consortium. And Michel and I had been fortunate enough to have been chosen as the representatives for our school among some, I think there's maybe 100, 120 people. Does that sound right?
I think it was smaller than that back
smaller.
Then. Probably maybe 70, 80, probably.
Okay.
As far as I can recall.
Now, I went back. I remember that there were a few real notables within our class. And I went back and I forgot that there were actually more notables than I had remembered. So let me, now for the general viewers, they may not remember this, but for people who are in our field, these names might sound familiar. So of course there's you, there's Nader Tavassoli, who's now at London Business School, a big guy there. There's Jennifer Acker at Stanford. There's Kent Grayson from Northwestern. Angela Lee also at Northwestern. So, there must have been something in the water in 1993 to produce, and I'm not speaking about myself, I'm speaking about you guys.
That was a great crop. There was also Peter Golder, who is at Dartmouth. Neeraj Arora, who is at Wisconsin. No, it was a very good year. I don't know what happened, but it was a very good year as far as I can tell.
Right. So I thought what we would maybe start by doing is talking about some of your research. While holding back on your Seven Sins of Consumer Psychology classic. That one I want to sort of address it separately. And so you were kind enough to send me some of the papers that you thought would be particularly interesting to discuss. I picked four of them, and so maybe I will sort of just prime you about each one, and you could tell us, you know, in layman's term, given our viewer audience, about each of them, because they all sound fascinating. So let's start with the following. The emotional oracle effect. I love that title. Tell us about that one.
I was sure you would pick that one. That's probably the one I would have picked as well.
Right.
It's so the you know, one of the things I've been trying to study over the last 20 years is really, you know what difference does it make when people rely on their feelings and emotions when they make decisions? And for many years before my time in the field, a lot of people had a very, you know, what is known as cognitive view of how people make decisions. We were treating consumers as if they were computers and they were very rational beings and so on and so forth. And if you know a little bit of human beings and in psychology, that is really not what is going on out there. And the earlier part of my career was about to try to show that consumers actually use their feelings a lot when they make decisions. And the latter part of the things I've done is to try to understand now, if they use their feelings to make decisions, what difference does it make? And the setting that we looked at in that research you're describing is about, all right, if people rely on their feelings to try to predict something that's going to happen in the future, does that help them or does that hurt them? Because rationally, what the common wisdom would say, feelings are not a good type of information to be relying on if you try to make, you know, quote unquote, rational and meaningful judgments. And we had, the general gist, big picture finding that we had in that paper is that when we have a method for getting people to trust more their feelings when they make a variety of decisions. And what we had them do in that paper is to try to say, okay, now there's an event going to happen in the future. We'd like you to predict which of two outcomes or which of multiple outcomes is going to take place. And what we found in general is that people were able to predict better. So we started noticing that in a study that was quite contemporary, if you will. It was in the 2008 presidential election, and there was a primary race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And we had this national sample of voters that we reached out to, and we had these methods administered to them that made them, half of them, rely more on their feelings. And we asked them, who do you think is going to win that race? And it was in February 2008, if I recall correctly, and that was not resolved until much later. It was around June that race, that primary race, was resolved. And it turns out that Barack Obama won, but the people who trusted their feelings predicted that at a greater rate than the people who didn't trust their feelings. And so we found that results, and then that prompted us to sort of look in other settings where we might be able to see this as well. And so we had people predict whether a movie at the box office, which movie is going to do better this weekend at the box office. And we found again that people who were encouraged to rely on their feelings were predicting better which movie is going to do better at the box office, which one's not going to do as well.
So let me interject before you go on. So does the effect seem to occur across domains and settings, or are you able to predict that for domains A, B, and C, this is where I think it'll happen, but E, F, G, it won't happen?
It's a very good question. One of the things that surprised us is how widespread the phenomenon was. So initially we had intuition that it would be in domains that where the outcome is driven by people's, popularity behavior. So people might say, I vote for Hillary Clinton, I vote for Barack Obama, and maybe when people try to predict that, rely on their feelings is a good predictor. And that's what would happen with the movies as well. But we were trying to find settings where we expected that not to be the case.
And it still happened.
And it still happened. And it's really one of those, normally as a researcher, often you try to replicate your own effect, and you're happy when it replicates. I must say, in that paper, the challenge for us was to try to get the effect to go away. and we actually went in different settings where we expected the effect not to hold, and we keep seeing it. And the one setting where we were the most surprised is when we had people try to predict the weather.
Right.
And we found again the results when they were trying to predict the weather. So to answer your question, where do we not find it? It turns out that there's two types of scenarios where you would not find it. One is when people just don't know enough about what they're supposed to predict. So we had a study in which we had people trying to predict the outcome of a football game, the college national collegiate football game that just played out last week between Alabama and Clemson. And we found that the people who know enough about football are able to predict greater if they run their feelings. People who just don't know anything about football, college football, are not able to. And the other setting where people will not do better is settings in which it's completely random. Right? Yeah. So we had them predict the weather like 2 weeks in advance. They can't predict it. So, which is not surprising. Okay, so what this finding is telling us is that when you rely on your feelings, you're able somehow to recruit some intuition of what is the most likely thing to happen. And the reason that is, and that's what we think is happening, is because in the background of our minds, as we learn and go about our lives, we encode a lot of information, not necessarily consciously. And when we have them, what do your feelings tell you? Your feelings essentially act as a summary of everything you have learned, and that has a lot more information than when you try to act, quote-unquote, rationally and try to isolate pieces of information that you may think is relevant or not relevant.
So if I could summarize what you just said, tell me if I'm right. So having access to those feelings allows you to retrieve elements that would have otherwise been non-retrievable had you not been in that state. Is that basically the bottom
line? That is exactly what we think is happening. Yes.
Very interesting. All right, let's go on to the next one. Okay. This one I liked. Being in a relaxed state increases the monetary values of products, which, by the way, let's apply it to the current context.
Yep.
Hopefully, if the people watching us right now are in a relaxed state because I've got a very sexy, deep voice, they will donate more money to my YouTube channel because they will value this conversation more. Am I right?
That's the prediction. That is a prediction.
So tell us about it.
So this is a project where the that result, we did not expect it beforehand, it turns out. It started, so here's the general gist. In our field, when we study feelings and emotions, we tend to separate good feelings versus bad feelings and see, does it make a difference? And, you know, obviously it makes a difference. It's not particularly surprising that it makes a difference. In that paper, what we're comparing is really, you know, but now, the good feelings, there are different types of good feelings. You can be either very excited, or you can be very relaxed, or you can be somewhere in between. In that paper is really about now, when you relax people, what does it do to their minds? And which is something that marketers try to do a lot, you know. So you bring them to a business lounge, you bring them to a spa, you bring them to a fancy hotel, or a nice vacation resort. The whole mindset is trying to create a certain experience that is relaxing. The question is that people can value the experience. That's one thing. But does it do something else beyond making the experience pleasant? And so what we're comparing in that paper is really people who are feeling relaxed against people who are feeling good, but not as relaxed. So what we found is that across a variety of tasks, people for some reason are willing to pay more, are willing to state the higher values for a variety of products that we just showed them. And we had a very, it was not an easy project to conduct because we had to create this state of relaxation in the lab. And so we have, you know, people who have to listen to music, relaxing music and things of that nature versus people who listen to non-relaxing music, but not stressful music. And ask them, okay, you know, how much would you be willing to pay, for example, for a gym membership? And that's the kind of question we have them. And in our studies, to give you a sense of the effect, the willingness to pay in the valuations changed by about 11%. So higher willingness to pay, a higher valuation, 11% more than when you're not relaxed, but not stressed out.
Very interesting. Now, of course, as you know, as somebody who sort of tries to biologize things and and Darwinize things, one of the ways that I can see as a possible extension of what you're talking about is to look for relaxation metrics that are physiologically based. So whether it be a hormonal state, and so that would be, I think, a very easy and obvious way to take the research that you're doing and then add that biological slash physiological element.
No, I'd love to. I remember when we were doing that project, I was thinking about other studies that we might have to do to flesh out the project further, and looking to the biology and measurements more carefully would have been an obvious way to go. Another direction where one might go is to think more about the application of that, you know, because we have these results and it seems to be quite robust. So we had it across a lot of studies. Now, what do you do with that? It has, you know, and testing it in the field and show that it does make a difference. You know, if you would create two store environments, one that you would test to be relaxing, the other one less relaxing, does that really have the effect that we think it should have based on our own findings?
Very interesting. All right, two more to go. This one was probably, I think, the earliest one of the ones that I've chosen is from the late 90s, where you looked at a negative emotion. So the valence was held constant, but the source of the negative emotion, I think it was anxiety or sadness, is what was being studied. And you showed that the way people interact with uncertainty or risk, was it, would be different depending on the source of that negative affect, correct? Tell us about that.
So early on, again, in our field, we're always just comparing positive feelings versus negative feelings, but we had an intuition, Raj Raghunathan and I, that the negative, you know, I mean, that not all feelings were the same, and not all negative feelings were the same, not all positive feelings were the same. And we started comparing two emotions, which were anxiety and sadness. And the reason we came to choose those two emotions is that they map very nicely onto a classic decision trade-off that people make all the time, which is a trade-off between risk and reward. And so very often what people have to do, they either go for an option that has a higher payoff, but these are long shots, you know, so these are the lotteries that which have a light, very large figures, but then there's a very small probability that you win.
We just had the winners of the Powerball, right?
Exactly. Right. It's a very, very current topic as right. well. And the other option that you have, of course, is one in which the odds are much better, but the payoff is just not as great. And so we picked those two because essentially what those two emotions do, really, is push people in opposite direction with respect to that trade-off. And in that paper, we also had a neutral state group. So we have an anxious group, and we had a sad group, and we had a neutral state group. And what you see is that compared to the neutral state group, they go in an opposite direction. The people who are anxious go for the smaller reward, higher probability types of option, where the people who are sad do the opposite. They go for the long shot, something that has a higher reward, but they are a lower probability. And both of these can be explained using fundamental principles of how emotions are supposed to shape our lives and signal the state of the environment in our lives.
On a related note, in the same way that you sort of drill down so that you're not just looking at the valence of the emotion, but you're looking at the source of that valence. I've done a similar drilling down, I mean, in a completely different context. This is a paper that I've yet to publish, regrettably, but hopefully will soon, where we looked at sex differences in envy, which is another important, can trigger a lot of emotional issues. But specifically what we wanted to look at, so if you ask basically men and women if they're envious of, say, same-sex rivals on general dimensions, then you won't necessarily pick up any sex differences. It's not as though women are inherently more envious than men or vice versa. But then if you come from, as you know, from an evolutionary lens, and recognize that there might be a sex-specific calculus to the triggers of envy that might make women envious of other women and men of other men, then you start picking up some huge sex differences, which I think most people would have an intuitive sense of what they might be. Men might be more envious of other men because of social status, women because of physical looks. And so again, by having the capacity to be more granular in your analysis, you're able to uncover some things that otherwise might have been invisible to you, right?
No, that's very nice. So I can see why your perspective helps enrich my perspective, which is about trying to understand the difference between different types of emotions. But I can see the other way around, that looking at difference between emotions is also putting some shedding some light on the difference between men and women that may be biologically driven. And so this is a nice nice angle that I can see would help you from your research support an evolutionary psychology explanation of many of those.
Beautiful. And the last one.
I like that result, yes.
And then we'll get to the seven sins, and I'll give an introduction to that paper, is the feelings in the ultimatum game. And I particularly chose that one because before I give you the floor, let me mention what the ultimatum game is to people who might not know. I've published a paper on the ultimatum game many years ago with one of my former doctoral students. The ultimatum game basically works as follows. And again, I'm not explaining this to you, it's to the viewers. Let's suppose you bring in two people into the lab, you give player A $10 and you tell him or her, please split this $10 with player B. There is no negotiation, there's no back and forth. Player A proposes the split. Let's say I'll keep $7, I'll give the other person $3. If player B accepts it, they both get their respective splits. If player B rejects it, they both get nothing. Hence, it's just an ultimatum. Now, I wanted to study, again, coming from an evolutionary perspective, what happens to these offers as a function of the sex makeup of the two players. There are four possibilities, right? Male, 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 female, female, male, female, female. And we had hypothesized that, of course, that variable would strongly affect the offers that are being made. And we hypothesized and found that when men are offering to women, this is where they want to exhibit cues of generosity. And when men are facing other men, this is where the intrasexual rivalry juices kick in, whereas women would be equally fair irrespective of who they're facing. And that's exactly what we found. And so with that background, I give you the floor as to what you did in your own study.
Okay, you have to remind me to tell you about another study that never was published and never was finished on the Ultimatum game, okay. which was by far maybe one of the most interesting study I did, which was it was a total failure.
It wasn't published because
it wasn't published because the results were completely flat. But I'll tell you about that one in a second.
Okay.
We have these methods for getting people to So in the Ultimatum games, there are two behaviors that are interesting. So it's the behavior of the person who's make the offer and the split to the player, and we call them the proposers. And there's the behavior of the person who receives that split and who may accept it or reject it. We call them the responder. And those two behaviors are fascinating. And in that paper, we studied the effect on the proposer. So what difference does it make if you trust your feelings as a proposer? And again, I did not expect the results that we got. But what we found is that the people who trust their feelings tend to make offers that, on average, are slightly less generous than the people who don't trust their feelings. And that's not necessarily what I expected. But the one thing that's fascinating, though, is that what was the level at which they made the offer? And when they made the offer, really the modal level at which the people who trust their feelings make the offer is 40%. So they actually give the other person 40% and they keep on themselves 60%. Now, that number happens to be an important number because most studies that have shown the behaviors of the responders have shown that at 40%, most responders accept it.
Right.
And so that is... turns out to be quite related to the phenomenon of the emotional oracle paper we discussed earlier, that when you trust your feelings, you seem to be able to get a good intuition of what seems to be the right thing to do. And most of these subjects, 99% of them have never played the game. This is the first time they're put in those situations. But somehow, trusting your feelings gives you some kind of an intuition of what is about right in terms of predicting the outcome. Is the person going to accept it, not accept it? And the feelings seem to be telling you, this is the right thing to do, play this way. And then on average, what you find is that, of course, they make a bit more money because their offers are not overly generous. And so they get to keep more. They are not overly greedy. They're not rejected too often.
So, I mean, go ahead, finish.
Go ahead. I'll tell you more about the other project. Okay.
I was going to say, what seems to be running through a lot of these studies is, number one, be in touch with your feelings, right? I mean, stereotypically, we often hear women saying, that's one thing I despise about men. They're not in touch with their feelings. And what you're demonstrating in very elegant and sophisticated ways is that it actually pays to be in touch with your feelings. And I wonder if that then somehow links to something that we often hear, certainly in academia, but in the popular sort of medium, about emotional intelligence. Is there any link between what you're doing and that construct?
No, there are links. There are somewhat, it's not identical. There's some of my findings are in line with this notion of emotional intelligence, but a lot of the emotional intelligence research and discourse out there has to do more with social interactions and being sensitive and empathetic and things of that nature. It does not really expand to the domain of making quote unquote rational decisions that are often taken to be devoid of emotional qualities. So there's some overlap. It's not identical, but it's connected.
I just found the title. It came to my head. The title, if you ever write a popular press book, here's the title of your book. And I want 5% royalties on any money you make. It is rational to be emotional.
I think that title is, I had in the early 2000s when I started actually seeing all these findings, it's all thing. Thinking about the rationality of emotions, I had come up with a term called emotional rationality, which is very similar to what you are suggesting. And I gave out lots of little talks among academics about my research and about the themes of that. one of the big regrets of my career as an academic is that I never took the time to really write a book that would have a broader audience, and that would have been a book that I would have liked to write, and maybe one day I'll still...
You're still a young guy. There's no reason to regret.
Hopefully I could do it.
Right.
Two thoughts though. First, on the first thing about, you know, you got to be in touch with your emotional feelings, etc. I think it's true in general, but there are a couple of things that people necessarily have to pay attention to, and it's not always the case that the emotional person, if you will, is going to do better. Right. Okay? One of the things that that I think is important to recognize is when you talk about emotionality, there's a whole continuum. Okay, it can go from being, you know, completely going upset and going berserk, completely crazy, and then taking a gun and shooting someone. That's not what we're talking about in my research. And there's no question that extreme levels of emotions, whether it be anger or passion or whatever, can lead you to do silly things. Okay. But you know, there's a whole continuum, you know, and feelings play a role in your life at this whole range of things, and there's a whole range of at which feelings, that it doesn't feel right or you feel good about something, on average, I think, really helps you, and it's really at the extreme that it hurts you.
Gotcha.
The other thing that I would say, and I've never tested it, and that's a part of the research that still remains to be done. But I think where the feelings are coming from is also important. And there's one of those, it's a little note in one of the findings that we had in this emotional oracle paper. We had one study in which people who trusted their feelings were able to predict at a higher rate who was going to win American Idol that season. And it was a season that had a guy called Chris, if I recall, and the other one, Adam Lambert. And the guy called Chris won, and then he was the underdog. He won this. It was a little bit of a surprise. But there are people who trusted their feelings who didn't know, predicted it well. And the reason is the people who happen to have, quote-unquote, inside knowledge about the person. So sometimes you have good feelings, not so much because your feelings are summarizing everything you know.
Right.
Sometimes you have good feelings because you have unique knowledge,
right,
and unique interaction with what you're supposed to predict, and those kind of feelings are dangerous, right? And so you may love, for example, Bernie Sanders for personal reason, let's say in the United States, and because you love of Bernie Sanders, if I were to ask you, is he going to win the primary? Is he going to win the presidential election? You might be tempted to say yes. But that feeling that you have there is not the right feeling to rely on.
Right.
And paradoxically, here's what I would say, and this is, I'm already disclosing something that could be a subject for a book, but I suspect that if you know where your feelings are coming from, this is probably not the right type of feelings that you need to rely on. Mm. It's only the feelings where you don't know where it's coming from that are the kinds that seem to summarize a lot of the information that would be useful to you to make a decision.
Very interesting nuance there. Do you want to...
Let me tell you about this project, if you don't mind.
Please.
This project that failed.
I was going to actually cue you on that, exactly.
Go ahead. All right. One of the things that you don't know is that my brother is an academic as well.
Ah.
And he's, by training, a clinical psychologist, he's well-published, and he's in Belgium. But he specializes on clinical populations, and his dissertation was about the emotional deficits of psychopaths.
Whoa! Okay.
Now that's
sexy stuff.
That is fantastic, yeah. And you know, the general finding is that the psychopath exhibits a lot of emotional deficits of different types, and that's what is contributing in part to their psychopathic behavior, antisocial behavior, criminal behavior. Now, as part of his research, what he does, he has access, well, he was a prison psychologist for a number of years, and he also had access, and he also has, he's the director in a mental hospital, director of research in a mental hospital. And within the mental hospital, he has a population of people who are internalized, and who score very high on psychopathy. And so what we did 4 or 5 years maybe ago, we is run a study combining playing the ultimatum games among that population. And the prediction that I had at that time is that and that we had at that time is that the psychopath, you know, subject, people who would classify as such based on the clinical measures, would be the classic economists,
right?
In the ultimatum games, you know, the economists make the prediction that in the ultimatum game, you really should be just giving like a dime,
the smallest denomination,
you know, a very smallest denomination possible, just because you know that the other person should accept it, otherwise they get nothing, and that's the critical rational economics prediction of how you should play the game. And we thought that maybe the psychopath would be doing that because, you know, they don't care about the other person, they don't care about the feelings, and so this was the prediction we made. And it was a very elaborate experiment because people are in cells, literally in cells, and so we had an assistant going from cell to cell with an envelope of money and then going and making the offers.
You have to publish this.
And no, but we couldn't publish it because we had a flat result. It was essentially everybody within that study split 50-50.
Wow.
Everybody split 50-50, regardless of level of psychopathy. And so what I suspect is happening in that stuff, because they're all part of the same institution.
Right.
And they say, we're all in the same boat and let's go 50-50.
Right.
And so that's not a publishable result, but
I love it. And I'll tell you, in mid-90s, and I might have mentioned this story with Brian Wansink, I'm not sure, but I had seen a plenary by George Lowenstein where he was talking about hot and cold cognitions, and that had motivated me to study dysphoria, which is the opposite of euphoria, which can, at its extreme, it can become clinical depression. And I wanted to study how dysphorics versus non-dysphorics might behave differently on a sequential decision-making task, which was the area of my doctoral dissertation. And that led me to think that, you know, it's such a shame that we don't study in consumer behavior clinical populations. And I had contacted at the time a clinical psychologist friend of mine to see if I could get access to some of his patients, but it was very, very complicated to do so. And so I simply measured, you know, regular people's dysphoric level, and a few, of course, fell almost in the clinical depression range. And so I think that's, as a general statement, I think it would be a wonderful opportunity for us to not just look to, you know, our undergrads and our MBA students as prospective participants, but to look at these very interesting populations, like clinical populations. So, for example, in some of my books, I talk about dark side, you know, the biological roots of dark side consumption, things like pathological gambling and compulsive buying and eating disorders and pornographic addictions. Well, all of those folks are within clinical populations. And so I guess this is going to probably lead us very nicely into the seven sins of consumer psychology, because what we're talking about here might easily be fitted within one of the seven sins. And so maybe we could move on to that. You wrote in, I think it was published in 2013, and you also gave a presidential address at the annual, you know, SCP conference, the Society for Consumer Psychology conference, a paper where you were basically saying very honestly, and I mean, you know, you were speaking at this point as the president of the society, which to me, it should be natural that we should have that self-insight. But in a world of sort of political correctness and diplomacy, it was, I think, hailed by many people as very courageous that you would stand up and say, look, we do great things, but we also do things poorly. And here are seven ways that I think we could improve. And I thought that was brilliant. I think that in 20 years from now, probably that paper will be remembered more than all of your other great works. That's my prediction. And I'm in touch with my feelings.
Possibly, yes.
So I don't know if you want to go sort of through each of them, or you want to give a general sort of broad statement. But I really think for people watching this, it'll be very instructive to hear your thoughts on the seven sins of consumer psychology.
Oh, well, thanks a lot for the kind words about that paper. It is a unique opportunity when, you know, you become the president of a professional organization to have essentially the audience on the stage, and nobody's going to interrupt you. So you have an opportunity to say what you truly think, and without having the censorship that you normally go through if you go through the academic publication process. And so I've been thinking about some of my frustration as an academic and as a researcher who participated in this field, that, you know, that's frankly, there's a lot of research that's just not very good, and that gets published is just not very good. And the question is that, what is it that in my mind makes research not very good? And it's not a matter of my own judgment. It's a matter of the fact that it's not very good to the extent that even though it's published, basically nobody reads it, nobody cites it, it has no impact. And this is really what I was trying to address. And so in our field, we've all long known that, you know, within the industry, people don't necessarily read what we do. But what was striking to me is that within academia, a lot of the stuff we do is not read either. And so clearly, if nobody reads it, that's a big problem. And I try to think about why is that? That somehow a lot of things is just not as impactful. And I came sort of to start to think about reason why I think it's not as impactful as it should be. And I sort of isolated the seven that I thought were the most critical, and this led to the title of that paper. I'll give you a couple of them, and you tell me the ones that you think are important. I have one favorite in my list.
But
one of the things that I call the sin of narrow scope is the fact that when you study consumption behavior, you should really be studying everything that leads to consumption and anything, so including the things that precede consumption and all the way to the things that follow consumption. And this is really what would lead to a lot of insight. And one of the things that we consistently do in our field, and most of our colleagues are in business schools, and they think that they study purchase behavior. And so what happens in the store, what happened right before that when people are presented with the options and try to make a choice. And that's clearly very important. But over and above that, there's lots of things that are perhaps even more important. So if you go further before that, what happens? What makes someone to want a product in it to begin with? Why is it that some people need a certain type of pillows? Or do people need a certain vacation or a cruise? And this is something that we have never really studied. Is what are the drivers of the needs to begin with? Whereas if you go to the industry and you ask people in industry, what would you want to know? I said, well, we try to sell more TVs, and it's not really about the choice process we're trying to understand. I said, you know, why do people would need more TV? What is it that nowadays they feel like they need less TVs? So there's a lot more relevant question to be asked about the need stage than about the choice stage or the decision-making.
Right.
Stage. So that's what I call the sin of narrow scope.
Right. No. Do you want to go on, or do you want me to
go ahead?
Yeah. So, I mean, let me build into that. So, rather than sort of having you go through maybe each of the seven, one of the things that I've talked about in my own criticism of the field is the idea of methodological fixation. This is a term that is not my term. It's from Sternberg and Grigorenko in a 2001 American psychologist paper, but I thought that the term was so beautiful because it perfectly captures what happens in consumer psychology and consumer behavior in general. This methodological fixation is basically the idea, colloquially put, of, you know, to the guy who's got the hammer, the world looks like it's full of nails, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, so if I'm a priming guy, that's what I do. If I'm a, you know, whatever, an experimentalist, I never do field stuff. And so what ends up happening, I think, in consumer psychology and or more generally consumer behavior is that people are great methodologists. They're really well-trained as in the practice of doing science, right? Yeah. And so if you look at the internal validity of most of the research, it's not always perfect, but you certainly can bet that given the rigor of the review process, you know, some reviewer is going to find every possible thing that you could think of. And so that there you get the check. But then if you ask the question, who gives a damn about what you are studying? Nobody does. Okay? I mean, yeah. And I'm being very blunt because it's really true. And I think, you know, and many of the seven sins that you mentioned, in a sense, relate to this general point, right? I mean, who cares? And I don't mean in the practical versus academic. Are you studying truly interesting stuff? That if you and I right now are chatting, and there's going to be 5, 10,000 people who are going to watch this clip, are they going, God damn, this is exciting stuff? Well, the reality is that if I read most of the papers in the leading journals, and I am vested in this field, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not interested, right? And so it fails on the, I don't know if you know the paper, that's interesting, 1971 paper, Philosophy of Science, where Davis basically proposed 12 criteria by which you judge if something is interesting, that it gets you that exclamation point. That's interesting. Yep. And I think many of the sins that you speak of, ultimately, yep, in one form or another, link back to that. Do you agree?
I agree that many of the ones I described are connected to that. And, my advisor, Joel Cohen, used a term referring to other researchers one day, and when I was still training under him. And he said, I think he or she has good taste. Right. And at that time, that seemed quite odd to me to be using that kind of language to refer to it, to a researcher's work. And it's only as my career progressed that I really somehow begun to appreciate really what it means, because it's very important. I do think that we train doctoral students very well in terms of the methodology. And by now, frankly, it's very difficult to see holes in research that gets submitted to the top journal, because people are so well trained in the science of doing tight studies. But what people are not necessarily good at and is really about taste, and that, thank God, maybe it's a good thing. Maybe thank God not everybody has good taste, because at least it still gives different people an opportunity to differentiate themselves on the people who have a good taste versus people who don't have good taste. But I do think that it's a big separator. One of the scenes that speaks to the thing that you describe is what I call the sin of research by convenience. So the researchers, they have their tools, and they know there are things that are relatively easy to do, and what they'll do is set up their research and their research questions around the things that are easy to do. And the research are easy to do, unfortunately, are not necessarily the research that is more interesting. Like, for example, the study that I described to you about the psychopath in the mental hospital, that was very, very hard to do. But it was interesting. If we had good result, we could have been published in a major journal, maybe in Science.
Right.
But it just didn't get the result. But that was and it's quite unfortunate, however, that there's this trade-off. The things that are easy to do are usually not necessarily the stuff that is interesting. That's what I like Brian Ronsing's research so much, because a lot of his research is not easy to do, but he asked very good questions and very interesting questions.
And as I think you might have seen I know you watched our chat.
Yeah.
I mean, I could pretty much pick up any paper that Brian Wansink has written, and I go, God damn, that was interesting, right?
No, exactly. Because, how did he come to
how did he think of it? Because I'm going to add to your brilliant supervisor's beautiful term, taste. Let's coin a term right here in front of everybody. It's epistemological taste, right? I mean, it's right. People have fashion taste. Well, I mean, if I can speak of myself, I won't dare say if I have epistemological taste or not, but here's what I do have. I have broad intellectual curiosity. Now, it has actually harmed me in terms of my career, right? Because I don't play by the rules of I only publish in these journals. I genuinely don't care. Maybe I should care more, because I just find an interesting problem. For example, if you had approached me and said, hey, Gad, you want to work on the psychopathy paper? Before you finish that sentence, I would have said, I'm on board. Now, would it have likely been published in JCR? Probably not. Now, if I wanted to go down that careerist track, I should have thought. But so in reality, what we need to do maybe, and certainly people like you who are sort of the editorial gatekeepers can help in doing, is there a way to change the reward metrics in our field so that we don't succumb to these biases?
It's a very big challenge. I totally agree with you that it all boils down to incentive structure. And right now, the way the field is set up is that your career is going to advance as a function of A-level papers that you have published. So if you publish 10 A-level papers, that's fantastic. If you publish 5, that's not going to be as great. And this is almost a linear mapping between people's career success, the schools that they end up teaching at, where they get tenure, the salaries they might get, the reputation they have. is really almost linearly predicted by the number of A-level papers that they have published. This is not necessarily a recipe for scholarship. And I got to think a little bit based on some other readings on what does it mean to be a scholar. And interestingly, if you ask a layperson what is a great scholar, they will tell you about someone who is very deep thinking, is someone who is broadly read, who knows a lot, can think about clearly, but there's nothing in the layperson's definition or conception of a great scholar that really speaks to the number of A-level papers they have published. We will not say this is a great scholar. Oh, this person has published 100 articles, a great scholar. No. People say, do they know a lot?
Right.
Do they have a clarity of thinking? And do they have a critical mind? And are they broad and well-read? This is what as a layperson would define as a great scholar. Now, if you look at the way our field is set up, we don't reward great scholars per se. You know, we know the only thing that they get as great scholars, they get more manuscripts to review because they tend to be very good at reviewing manuscripts, which is in fact a punishment. You know, so we send them lots of stuff to read, and what we only review is you know, do you publish a lot of papers?
Right,
which is not, I would say, it's orthogonal, but you know, it's. It's not the same. In fact, you can publish a lot by reading a little bit less and then just cranking out more studies.
Right.
But it's not necessarily the great scholarship in the general definition of the term.
So true. And I guess that leads me to the next question, which is the role of a professional intellectual. And I also, by the way, raised this with Brian Wensing, but of course I want to get your take. And that is that, you know, I mean, we're professors in a business school, right? We teach marketing, right? So when it comes to the marketing of ideas and the engagement with ideas, most professors in the business school are abysmal. And in the following sense, we have these unbelievable opportunities with all of the social media tools that are at our disposal to be engaging the larger audience in a myriad of ways. Now, for example, publishing in those A-level journals that you're speaking of is wonderful and great. Go for it. But there are many other hats that as a professional intellectual, you and I should be doing. And regrettably, very few of our colleagues, and I'm not sure why, maybe you could offer some hypothesis as to why that is, they don't. So if you look at Twitter presence or public Facebook page presence or media presence, where we expect people who are trained to think critically and clearly to have important things to say, everybody shies away from it. That's a shame, and I wonder, I mean, what are your thoughts on that, and can we change the incentive structures to make more and more people comfortable engaging in the public?
I do think there are two reasons why people are not doing it more. First of all, I totally second your observation. It is true that if you look at the people around us, the 2,000 marketing academics that we may know, very few are prominently out there marketing their thoughts to a broader audience, which is quite amazing why we're not doing it. You know, it's incredible. In fact, if you look at the students, they would respect us more, honestly, if they would see us on YouTube, on Facebook, on the news, than if they were to somehow see the collection of journal or consumer research articles we have published. There's no question about that. I do think there are two reasons. Okay, one again has to do with incentives. You know, I just finished writing my activity report for this past year, and it is no question that as I write it and as many of my colleagues write it, we feel and it's probably true that the only thing that counts is really, again, this number of A-level papers that you have published and maybe the citations, possibly not even that. And all the other stuff is seen as a potentially distraction from that ultimate goal that is put upon us by institutions. And that's one. I do think, though, there's another reason. I suspect that a lot of marketing academics and a lot of academics in general, and that's why they're academics, are socially anxious. And they just are not very comfortable being out there, you know, just socially. And now, you know, so, and that's really, you know, the reason why they are academics, they just like to read, they like to be in the office by themselves, and to put them, you know, to even though I see their behaviors, you know, when I do programs, executive programs, and I can sort of see sometimes some of my colleagues how they interact with executives out there. I can sort of see the nervousness that that some of my colleagues have, and that's I think it's fairly common trait among academics. And we're business school academics, so we should be normally very comfortable interacting with the general audience, the businesses, etc. And so that's if people are socially anxious, that makes them even less likely to put their face out there like you're doing. And you're right. Doing a fantastic job at what you're doing, and I'm glad that you're doing it. And I think there should be more of that, and there should be more metrics in institutions to reward the popularization of ideas.
I'll tell you a great story. I don't remember if I've ever mentioned this before. If I have, apologies to the viewers if you've already heard it. Last year I applied for a big government grant, the equivalent of what would be called the NSF in the National Science Foundation grant, the equivalent version in Canada. And all the reviewers were, it was all very nice. There was one reviewer who had a massive beef with me. I don't know who it is. It's confidential. But one of the things that he or she was particularly, had disdain for me is because I was very known, right? And so the person would list, right? I mean, this guy is in the media and there are millions of people who read his stuff. And what a horrible thing. I mean, who would think that an academic who's read by 4 million people is inherently not doing a better job than an academic who's read by 3 reviewers and an editor? I'm sorry, sir, I have sinned, right? I mean, it's just... Yeah. And so his whole line of attack was that I was this sort of popularity hound, right? And so unless you're able to expunge this kind of profound stupidity and haughtiness, right? I mean, I'm a man of the people, right? I mean, I don't believe that I should only be talking to Michel Pham because he's my equal, right? If I'm doing important stuff, then the people who pay for my salary should have access to this, right? So it's precisely, it's my humility that causes me to interact with everybody because I think that I should be able to excite them. But this person thought that I was this sort of sellout, instead of being an artist who only plays in front of 4 people, I had gone billboard. And so it was just breathtaking.
That is 2 thoughts about that. I mean, so first of all, so not only the incentive is not there, right? But the what you just pointed out, that there is in fact a disincentive for doing that. You know, people would punish you.
Yeah.
For having written a popular book, and people will say, he or she has sold out. He's become the consultant, he's become the guru, and whatever. And we look down on them, and that's sad because that's not a business school professor should be someone who is able to reach a broad audience, and as well as having a tight mind. What it speaks though is, and this is where we go back to psychology. It has to do also with the lay intuition people have about the correlation between traits. Okay, so people think that there's a correlation between tastes good and unhealthy, and tastes healthy and tastes bad, right? And so and those correlations have a lot of impact on what we choose to eat or not eat. And the same thing happens, and people have this intuition that someone who is popular must be definitely a less rigorous scholar, and whereas I think these are orthogonal dimensions. It's really a matter of how you spend your time, and that needs to be tested. There are certainly very good scholars who have hit it both ways and done very well. I think Brian's a great one within our field, a great scholar whose research I like, from a scientific norm standpoint, but has been able to reach a broad audience. And there are scholars who are mediocre in both dimensions, right? And so conceptually, at least, the correlation is not high. I don't know empirically what it is.
Well, I think you get a similar incorrect correlational link between being a great teacher and being a great scholar, right? So you often people think that these things are mutually exclusive, right? I mean, yep. If you're a great scholar, you inherently must really be bad when you get up. And if you're very good in reaching your students, surely you must be a poor scientist, but you can't be both. Well, yep. I could name off the top of my head 10 people right now who are, you know, breathtakingly accomplished scientists, who are some of the most eloquent speakers. Actually, one of them that I recently communicated with, you may not know him because he doesn't run in our circles, Robert Sapolsky is a neurobiologist at Stanford, who is a, you know, profoundly accomplished neurobiologist. Certainly his metrics would make anybody in marketing be stand up and take notice. And yet if you go to YouTube and watch the number of views of some of his appearances, I mean, it's just breathtaking, right? He gives a lecture, there are 900,000 views.
Oh my God.
Right? I mean, right? So again, we need to change the currency of how we define ourselves. We are meme creators,
yeah,
and we do that through our science, and we are meme propagators. Put those two together, and you've got the ideal intellectual. And so hopefully these types of conversations that we're having are not going to change the field overnight, but hopefully they serve as a start of a discussion on these important issues, right?
Hopefully, yeah, hopefully. There's a lot of things that need to change. It's not going to happen overnight. In one of my pet project, it's, you know, back of my mind as a follow up to the Seven Sins paper, is to promote another metric for measuring people's impact. And it's a bit too early to reveal what it would look like, but I do think that unless additional metrics that are easy to grasp, that have an intuitive appeal, that are easy to report, are being promoted in the field, it's going to be tough to change behaviors on a large scale. Now, right. You know, you and I are at a stage in our career where we can afford to take risk, and, you know, right. And so hopefully more people like us will be doing it. Hopefully, you know, you have taken much more risk than I have. But perhaps this is not the assistant professors who need to take those risks.
Right.
But hopefully, if there are enough people who choose a slightly different career path later on in their careers, right. You know, hopefully people, this will become...
Well, and I think, somebody like you, who obviously stood as an important influencer in the field, when you are on record saying this, yes, it's true that the assistant professor may not have the courage today to do whatever we're asking him or her to do, but there is social proofing, right? I mean, he's looking at somebody who he obviously highly respects, who he'd like to emulate, who's saying, hey, I'm here on record saying that things need to change. So I think this conversation might hopefully be more influential than we might otherwise hope for. So let's see. Two more questions. So question one, it kind of relates to what we're talking about, careers and so on. You're about midway through your career. We both are.
Yeah.
Up to now, what would you say?
Midway is a bit generous. You know, I mean, this is, well, yeah, it's about. You know,
no, it's okay. Why not? Are you? Did you hit the 5-0 yet or not yet?
Yes, I did.
So did I. So what are some of the things that you love most in your profession as a professor? And what are a few things that you dislike the most? And I ask this because, you know, a lot of people write to me saying, hey, you know, I watch what you do and I would love to be an academic. What are the pros? What are the cons? So I'd be curious to know, what are your take on this question?
I as being a professor or being a business school professor?
Whatever you'd like. I mean, I think first as a professor, and if you want to then, drill it down to business school, if there's anything
I love the intellectual stimulation that comes being an academic and being allowed to explore things and make a living out of satisfying my own curiosity. That is amazing. And a lot of academics have this freedom to explore ideas and test them. And, you know, if I were to turn my camera the other way around, you would see my bookshelf is full of books, and I get paid to read them. You know, and that to me is fantastic. The second thing is life as an academic is terrific. Is the fact that we are constantly working on new ideas, on new projects. Very often when people from industry comes to me and say, you know what, I'm trying to change my career and I want to do a PhD. And very often they tell me, you know what, I'm tired of doing the same thing over and over again. And whereas in academia, you essentially get a chance to do, yes, you do research over and over again, but you get to do research on new projects, and very often you are setting those projects agenda on your own. I love, to be honest, not having a boss. Okay, I mean, I have a boss officially, but you have an enormous freedom over how you allocate your time. You work a lot of hours, but you at least are dictating what those hours should be and when they should be, and that to me is a great perk of the business. Now, being a business school professor and a consumer researcher, I would say there's a couple of things that I think are interesting. One is the ability to connect what you do with things that are happening in the real world, because everybody is a consumer. So there's an intuitive appeal with a topic which may seem very mundane, you know, consumption behavior. You know, you buy a Coke at a dollar. What is there to studying that, you know, when you dig scratch below the surface, there's a lot of richness that comes along with that, that provides you an opportunity to connect what you do with people's real lives. So that's appeal number one. The second appeal is the fact that we happen to be in a field that is interdisciplinary, or at least it's meant to be,
right,
where there's a lot of different perspective for studying the same research of questions, sets of questions. And so you look at it from a virtually psychology perspective, I look at it from a social psychology perspective, others have adopted anthropological perspective and so on and so forth. So that is a great thing about our field. And the third thing is that it's a field that is a healthy field, because there's money pouring into the field. It's just, it's really, it's going to do as well as the business field does. And so it's not, you're not starving as an academic, right. You know, it is something that will always have relevance and we, at least if done well,
right.
and will be remain is an area for investigation.
Yeah. The downsides?
Downsides, to be honest, of being a professor or being a professor in a business school?
Professor, general.
Being a professor, I think one of the things that bugs me is when people, when you go to a dinner party or a cocktail party and people ask you, what do you do for a living? I say, oh, I'm a professor. And they say, oh, okay. And the question I always have is like, what do you do when you're not teaching? You know, and it's this question, like this perception.
You surf, right? You go surfing, don't you?
Yeah, I go surfing. Yeah. I have this tan I got nothing else to do. It's only 3 months a year or whatever, 6 hours per week, and it's incredible this lack of recognition of the workload that a professor who's active has. I was speaking to a colleague of mine just wishing, he's an accounting guy, and the guy spent several years at a major investment bank. So he left academia and then came back to academia, and he told me, you know, my blood pressure was lower when I was at that firm, you know, and because we have so many jobs to manage, and so that's perhaps one of the things that that may be a downside of the business. But frankly, perhaps another downside is the not having enough opportunity to see the impact of what you think.
Right.
On the real world, it's always a challenge. If you're a teacher, if you're a math teacher, let's say in high school, you have immediate metrics of whether
right.
whether what you're doing is does it work or doesn't work, not right. work. If you're a scientist and working in a university, you don't necessarily have the immediate feedback on the long-term and true implication.
You know how you get it? You get it by doing these public engagements as we're doing right now, right? Because when I put up this clip and within 3 hours or whatever it is, 3 days, you know, 5,000 people have watched it. I've received 100 emails about it. You know, and it's not, you know, it's not a narcissistic thing, right? It's not as though I'm doing it so that people can send me emails, but it is immediately getting me feedback that people are consuming what I'm doing and are appreciating it, right? When we work on an academic paper that takes, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from the inception of the idea to go through the review process, that's brutal. Of course, we have to do it. I mean, ultimately, we're professional. Go ahead.
Some of my papers, I tallied some of them. Some of my papers took 11 years. I think that's my record, 11 years. And I had several that took about 10 years.
From inception to end or just a review? No, yeah, okay.
No. From inception to end.
Right. Go ahead.
It's a relaxation paper that you discussed earlier. After it got published, in 2011, I went back with Jerry Gorn, who is a good friend of mine.
Great guy.
We were thinking about starting great guy. We were still thinking about starting a next project because we actually are working on this project because we are friends and we said, okay, let's do something together. And so I went back to my notes and my emails from when we started, and it was starting in 2000.
Okay, well, I'm going to beat that record.
Okay.
I have a paper that came out last year. It's a paper on – it's one of my few non-evolutionary psychology papers. It was the data was collected with one of my former MSc students as part of his thesis. He defended his thesis, I think, in 1998 or 99, and the paper was published in 2015. So I beat you.
Yeah, I have a long way to go.
But, you know, you mentioned something, and then I'll get to the final question and we'll wrap it up. You mentioned something about the freedom that, you know, that is afforded in academia. And I often tell people that, look, I work, you know, 18-hour days, but yet I always feel free because there is nobody who is imposing on me a particular schedule. And this actually, I'm going to link it back to something I mentioned earlier, Robert Sapolsky, the neurobiologist. He had studied baboon cortisol levels, depending on where they are in the hierarchy. And he showed that, you know, guys who are, or baboons who are lower on the hierarchy had greater cortisol levels than guys higher on the hierarchy, which you might think opposite possibly, because you might think the higher I'm up, the more stressful my life is. I've got to protect against all these other guys trying to take my job. Now, that study or that rough finding was replicated with cortisol levels of people who are in professions of different statuses. And it turns out that the CEO has actually lower cortisol levels than the factory worker. And you would think, well, how could that be? The factory worker does the same thing. Everything is set for him, whereas the CEO has incredible pressures. And, of course, cortisol is a hormone that is a stress hormone, right? And so it captures how much stress you have, and it's got a lot of downstream negative effects on your health. Well, the argument for why that CEO has lesser levels of cortisol is very much related to the freedom point that you mentioned, which is that the fact that you've got freedom to navigate through your day actually serves as a strong protector against stress, even though you're working 18 hours a day. But the poor chap who is told when he can go relieve his bodily functions from 9:50 to 9:55, he actually experiences greater stress. So you're definitely onto something in terms of your freedom argument.
It's a great finding, and I come to appreciate my job even more after hearing it.
There you go. Last question, which is kind of a strange way to end it, but I think a very topical one. I don't know if you've been following all this stuff, and I've been at the forefront of, if I may say, of fighting all this stupidity. Microaggressions, safe spaces, trigger warnings. Has that at all entered your reality at Columbia Business School? If yes, tell us about it. And if no, tell us about what your position on this whole thing is.
I got to be careful that one here. Because
I'm testing your capacity to break out of the bubble.
My academic freedom.
There you go.
There's no question that there's more tension, as you know, on campuses that puts I think a laudable goal, which is inclusiveness and respect and empathy and so on and so forth, which is one side of the argument, with another one, which has been a longstanding goal and in fact should be a longstanding mission of an academic institution, which is the diffusion of science and knowledge and ideas and the intellectual discourse that comes along with this. And so clearly now we are hearing more clashes. I think that I do feel it more than
and that students are exhibiting sensitivity if you raise issues A or B.
I discussed a result, a scientific result. It was marked as such on my notes. It was teacher course on consumer insight, and I had a slide that was showing a result of a finding by Gavin Fitzsimmons and Andrea Morales, that paper is about the effects of contagion of disgust.
Oh,
and
yes,
so,
yeah, sure.
So the finding in that paper is that, you know, when there are products that for which some people might experience disgust, you know, and others that people have an appetite for, and if you touch these, if the two products touch in a shopping cart, then people somehow imagine that there's some kind of contagion from one product into the other one, and tend to avoid the products. So that's the result. And this one of the study that I recall from that paper and that I was quoting is the fact that they use as the quote unquote disgusting product women hygienic napkins. And the
I know where this is going, but go ahead.
You know where this is going. I relayed the findings in my class, and there was some student who got upset that what I was relaying was conducive, not a hostile environment to what women. So, you know, and it was a scientific finding. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Well, I think so. And nowadays, you know, and this is where now you go back to the to how the times have changed. Those things are becoming even more and more an issue, not just because of the culture that has changed, but this is being amplified by social media. So, yeah. So now, you know, everything gets recorded and everything can be shared and everything can be distorted, taken out of context, and could be used to damage people's reputations.
You know, I could tell you this. I had a Twitter exchange at one point with a very, very famous psychologist. I won't mention him because I don't want to, well, for obvious reasons, not to, I don't want to shame him or anything, where he was disagreeing with me at the time regarding my position on trigger warnings. And then, of course, now that there is a greater number of people speaking out against trigger warnings, and I dare say that I was very much at the forefront of being one of the few ones who was really repeatedly mocking and satirizing this profound attack on just freedom of speech, now he seems to have changed his tone. I thought at one point of sending him an email saying, boy, have your views changed? But I don't want to gloat, so I took the gracious approach. But I mean, my point is that I think that as more people in important roles in academia, and I think there was a president of a university who came out very forcefully saying, look, this has to stop. Universities are about exchanging ideas. If an idea makes you feel uncomfortable, then you shouldn't be in university. Now, that to me shouldn't be such a shocking statement for a university president to make, but he was hailed as a courageous hero for saying something that otherwise should be profoundly banal. So I think it's important that we go on record saying, look, of course we want to be empathetic to everybody. And if somebody truly has some triggering thing that they want to discuss with you privately, fine. But to have to put a trigger warning for every possible topic that falls under the sun becomes just an Orwellian reality that we have to fight against, right?
I think it's also connected to another trend in academic institutions that you're probably aware of, is the shifting of decision-making power from the faculty, who used historically to be really administering the universities and taking terms, to a professional administration structure where a lot of these rules are coming up. And so there's a book that's on my shelf right behind me. It's called The Fall of the Faculty, where, you know, the it's an academic somehow who surveys and shows that universities have bloated themselves over the years with layers and layers of administrative structure, and that administrative structure is taking more and more on decision-making role, and some of it is just not value-adding. A lot of it is not value-adding, and it's contributing to those kind of things that are happening in the classrooms that did not used to happen.
That's a fantastic point, by the way, and it was raised in another book that I want to plug called Unlearning Liberty by Greg Lukianoff. He was actually one of a guest on my show. He's a First Amendment lawyer who's the president of FIRE. FIRE is the Foundation of Individual Rights in Education. And so his organization files lawsuits against universities when they violate either staff or professors or students' First Amendment rights. And you might say, well, how does that happen? Well, whenever you've got university speech codes, you can't say this and don't say that and don't say this word, by definition, the speech code is in violation of the First Amendment. Or something like this. You're allowed to speak freely, but we're going to designate a free speech zone for you where you're allowed to speak freely on campus. I mean, that's breathtaking, right? I mean, the United States is a free speech zone, not a particular zone at Columbia University next to McGuire Building, right? Yeah. And so he actually raises exactly the same point that you do, and that is that the professional sort of administrators that have come in to justify their existence come up with ever new ways to make life hellish for everybody, including the imposition of these speech codes. So you're right on point. Anything else you want to say before we wrap it up, Michel?
It's been a great chat. I mean, keep up the good work, you man. I'm very impressed.
Oh, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure having you. Of course, we could go on for another 3 hours. I will put a link to your website. Is there anything else that you want to promote, or is that it? Is there a project or a lab page or something that you'd like me to maybe point to in the description of the?
You can point to that the link to the Seven Sins address, which is somewhere on YouTube.
I'll find it.
Be connected, because it's people can sort of see what are the other six things we didn't get to discuss.
Perfect. Stay on the line. I'm gonna stop the recording. Thank you so much, Michel.
Thank you.